So I guess what I'll do today is talk a little bit about the fall of communism. It's hard to believe because, you know, all that happened. Now it's already, next year will be the 20th anniversary of the fall of the wall. And and you guys were not born yet, a few of you. Some of you were born in 1990, is that possible? Were you born in 1990? Some of you in 1990? Well, that's after the wall fell. I can remember seeing on TV the sort of quick trial of the Ceausescus and them being gunned down in the garden behind their house, and they were really a nasty pair. But the whole thing, now it seems like old history. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that and then talk about kind of global challenges and themes that we've talked about. Now we talk about immigration, we talk more about globalization, but I'm going to talk a little bit about that too. So let's do that, and then we're out of here. This is history. To some of you here, it's not history at all. It's something that we all lived through and in a way anticipated, and then saw developing. I mean, we were in France when all that was happening, and just listening on the radio and BBC and all this stuff, really quite amazing. Well, the big difference, of course, that made possible the dramatic changes that happened in Europe in Eastern Europe between 1989 and 1992 must begin with a guy who, independent of the fact that the Soviet system just didn't work, but with a guy whose declining reputation in Russia I find just incredible. And that's Mikhail Gorbachev, who, you know, it was relegated a few years ago. He actually did a TV ad for Burger King, at that point, because he needed the money. And his sort of fall, the fall of his image in the former Soviet Union and in Russia, I find that extraordinarily hard to imagine, because it made all the difference in the world that when people in Hungary and in Czechoslovakia, which then split between the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and in Poland and in other places, but mostly those three places, when they began to push for reforms and they decided that they wanted to reform communism, or they didn't want even communism at all. The big difference was in 1953, when there were riots in Berlin, in East Berlin, and I'm old enough to remember, crossing the border, the wall in East Berlin. You know, they were squished like grapes. And in 1968, when Dubček, who ends up basically with janitorial duties after that, when Dubček tried to put a human face on communism and reform communism, there were, as the expression goes, tanks before tea time. The Soviet tanks rolled in and squished them too, like grapes. And they had their martyrs in Wenceslas Square. One guy burned himself to death, and it's still in protest. It's still a memory embedded in the collective memory of that place. But there was a big difference. There was a big, big difference. And that Gorbachev made clear that there wouldn't be tanks before tea time. And when he went to Berlin, and when he went to Prague, and his name became a sign of protest, when they're chanting Gorby, Gorby, they're chanting for the demands of reform in their own states. And when the various groups that had been meeting off and on, particularly in Poland and Hungary, where dissidence was most developed and where there was an alternate kind of civic societies or civic space developed, the Gorby's name had become symbolic with the possibility of change. And he made clear that there weren't going to be tanks sent in. And at that point, these huge changes were inevitable. But these changes in Eastern Europe, in the former satellite states, really were facilitated, were accentuated, were made inevitable by the fact that communism didn't work, that the line in the Soviet Union, that the client lines were longer and longer. There was more attention to consumer goods, but also that Gorbachev was a very different leader. Gorbachev was educated. Unlike Brezhnev, who was his extremely elderly predecessor, he could give a speech without reading it off note cards. Well, Ronald Reagan really couldn't either. But Gorbachev was compelling. He was smart. He was educated. He understood the system. He'd come up through the system, and he was committed to change. But until the very end, even when they kind of kidnap him, not kind of, they kidnap him, and he's held under house arrest in Crimea, he stuck until the end with the belief that communism could be reformed and that you could put a human face a la Dubček. He didn't look at Dubček as a model, but on communism, and until the very end, I mean, he believed that you could have communism, this good idea gone terribly wrong, that could be reformist. So he was very, very different than his predecessors. Khrushchev has often been underappreciated. I mean, Khrushchev, after all, did come out against Stalinism in the famous Party Congress and all of that. And Khrushchev was a very wily guy who knew a lot about agriculture, and in some ways was a compelling character. But then his disappearance in 1964, isn't that when Khrushchev leaves power in 1964? He was followed by a couple of really orthodox Stalinians. And Gorbachev's rise really must be seen in that context. Gorbachev was born in southern Russia in 1931. He worked his way up, as you had to, in the party organization. He studied law at the University of Moscow, and he knew the West and respected many things about the West. He also knew how just devastating Stalinism had been for his own country. Both his grandfathers had been arrested on false charges when he was a boy. He was very talented. He knew how to manipulate the system, and he becomes secretary of the Communist Central Committee, and like Khrushchev before, and his origins, was responsible for Soviet agriculture. And unlike his predecessors, really including Khrushchev, he was less xenophobic. He had less of this suspicion of non-Russians, and the Soviet Union was dominated by Russia. Let us leave no doubt about that. And so he believed that the communist dream had been destroyed by Stalinism and by the rigidity of the structure and by the inability to enact serious economic reforms. And the Soviet Union, like the other powers, had simply miserable economies, miserable economic situations. The European satellites, Eastern European satellite states, in many ways victimized by unfavorable economic arrangements with the Soviet Union, who exploited them, but nonetheless they were able to be kept afloat by the Soviet Union. And so he embraces the really only two terms that I didn't send these out, to be remembered, I suppose. And one is the policy of liberalization, which is called glasnost, openness in government combined with a greater degree of free expression. He takes people who were liberals, who are real reformers, not just party hacks, and he gives them positions of responsibility. And he realized that, look, if you live in northern Russia, you can see Finnish television. If you live in Estonia, where the language is somewhat similar to Finnish, that most difficult of languages, you can see what's going on. And these images of, as in East Berlin, the images of West Berlin and of a different way of life, and that you can't simply pretend that there wasn't a better way of life for many people. There are lots of people in the former Soviet Union may have had their doubts within the following 10 years about the kind of runaway bandit capitalism, high crime capitalism that developed in Russia and has victimized Russia and Bulgaria in particular, and other places as well. But he spoke openly, publicly, about the failings of the system. And that was the hush-hush word. You didn't talk about the failings of the system. You were always talking about the radiant future. Remember the radiant future. But the future wasn't radiant. There were long lines. It just simply didn't work. And he realized that you know, if you're going to supply the cities with consumer goods, you have to return to the free market. You really have to return to the old, you know, new economic policy, you know, that you already know about in the early 1920s. And he also, the second is perestroika, the restructuring of the whole system, with the belief that he had that communism could be made responsible to the desires of ordinary people in the Soviet Republic. He said, and he could toss off memorable phrases very easily. He was an extremely bright guy. He's still very much alive. We need a revolution of the mind. That you had to recommence with zero. You had to begin from the beginning and reconstruct this reformed communism that would be responsive to ordinary people. Now, it didn't work out the way he thought it was going to work out. The entire system collapsed. And three things made this possible. The fall of communism in the Soviet Union and in Eastern and Central Europe. First, within all of these states, but most notably the Baltic states, where people held hands, they formed a human chain all the way across Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, holding hands, a human chain across the entire Baltic region. That these places had strong nationalist movements, such as the Lithuanian movement that we discussed earlier, and these continued. Also in Eastern Europe, particularly in Hungary and in Poland. But also in Ukraine. Remember, Ukraine is a different language. It's a related but different language. There's still huge problems because so many Russians still live in Ukraine, and we don't have time to talk about the ethnic complexities of these regions. I mean, the Russians who were left in Latvia, where there were the greatest, more Russians were in Latvia than in Estonia or Lithuania, I mean, faced all sorts of discrimination, and this is a problem. But anyway, these cultural demands, these nationalistic demands could not be placated by talk about a reformed communism. Because in the Soviet Union, the idea that the republics were equal was a sheer myth. And the idea that there would be, you know, tolerance, the toleration of different ways of looking at the world, there was some showcase stuff about the flowering of the cultures, but it was basically myth. Secondly, in 1989, in these countries, amid economic crisis, the great horrors of deprivation, the long lines of people wearing threadbare coats, waiting for trams that were late, a reform movement, a politically democratic movement, emerges in all of these states. In Russia, it was led by the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Andrei Sakharov, who had helped develop, of all things, the hydrogen bomb. And then, whereas the works of Solzhenitsyn, whose vision, you have to separate Solzhenitsyn's critique of the Gulag from his vision of the return of the Tsar or whatever. But Solzhenitsyn used to run into him here in Sterling Memorial Library. He was here for a year or two working the stacks in the collection there. But Solzhenitsyn, whereas before his stuff on the Gulag was passed from hand to hand, you know, typescripts passed secretly from hand to hand, you could read it. You could read Solzhenitsyn on what was the increasingly no longer hidden secret of the Gulag, and what happened to people sent to the Gulag. And so these dissidents begin to reach an increasing audience within all of these countries, within all of the Soviet republics and in the United States. You know, Gorbachev comes to Washington, D.C., in the mall, and he scares the hell in a country that had political assassinations, you will remember this one, out of those people who are supposed to protect him, because he leaves the limousine and plunges into the crowd and gives the Russian equivalent of high fives and shake hands with people. And they were just scared to death. I mean, someone's going to blow him away. And he charms the Reagans And of course, his intellectual capacity was many times those folks. But I mean, at least his interest. I shouldn't say capacity, his interest. But he charms people because he was a real, live, functioning, you know, intellectual in politics, committed, obviously committed in putting his reputation and putting the whole estate on the line. And so this was the second thing. And third, it was the acceleration of this economic crisis. Things weren't getting better. Poland is the great example of that. The reason that Solidarity starts in 1980 in the shipyards of Gdansk, it's bizarre to go back there. They're probably going to close. There's huge pictures of the Pope all over the place. But it still is a site of memory when you go to Gdansk. And the reason that Solidarity starts with Lech Walesa, and not just alone, and my friends in Poland, who are a little bit younger than Lech Walesa, and lots of other people, is because there wasn't enough to eat. You had a terrible situation. And so they unionized. They said, we're going to put forth our claims like unions had done in France and in Italy and in Spain and other places. Or as people had wanted to do in the early days of the Soviet regime, and they had been squished like grapes. Everybody's been squished like grapes. But the economic crisis makes these three things merge. Nationalist democratic reform, and the desire for economic change. And so you've got this charming man who takes big time decisions. Lots of Jews, for example, wanted to leave the Soviet Union. They were victimized by anti-Semitism there. They were often treated as second-class citizens. And Gorbachev finally says, yes, you can immigrate. You can go to Israel or the United States. And so things change. There's palpable change, and people have a sense of what's going to happen, that new things are going to occur. And the speed with which this happened took Western leaders by surprise. They weren't not, Thatcher, that's a good example. I mean, they were not ready for the speed of which these changes were coming. And so when people are shouting Gorby, 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 the subtext is that we want the reforms in Hungary, in Poland, in Czechoslovakia, and in other countries as well. But the movements were much smaller in Bulgaria or in Romania, which was under the police state of Ceausescu. The same situation in Albania, the kind of the cult of Hoxha, who was very tied to communist China, et cetera, et cetera. And he makes clear in Strasbourg, in a speech to the Council of Europe in July 1989, that he rejects the Brezhnev doctrine, his predecessor, Leonid Brezhnev, that the Soviet Union, as in 1953, and as of 1968, or 1956 in Hungary, I remember when I was a really little kid, I remember, Hungarian children who had been lucky enough to escape the revolution coming to Ainsworth School in Portland, Oregon. He said any interference in domestic affairs and any attempts to restrict the sovereignty of states, both friends and allies or any others, are inadmissible. And Gorbachev says that these movements in Hungary and Poland, that they are inspiring. He found them personally inspiring. And so the rest, as they say, is history. You've all seen images of the wall, first of young students, your age, putting flowers into the guns of the Vopo, who were the East German guards, flowers in the guns. And then the whole goddamn thing just collapses. That suddenly people are pouring over the wall, people on trains are, and the East German government, Honecker, was one of the very, very worst of all of them. I mean, he was really just awful, and Stasi infiltrated almost every organization. There's a great movie called The Lives of Others, a great, great movie that if this course went this far, I would recommend you see The Lives of Others, about spying and integrity and just all sorts of things. And, and Honecker was saying, give these people, return them to East Germany. And the Hungarians say, no, we won't return them to East Germany. And they start taking around the barbed wire borders around their own country. And the whole thing just happens like that. You know, within the Berlin Wall collapses, and with a month, the Ceausescu's, for better or for worse, are been gunned down in a garden after a very hasty televised trial. I mean, they were very, very bad people. There's no doubt about it. But there was no due process. But that was the end of that. And Honecker, whose slogan was always forward, never backward. I mean, till the very end, he was. And the Czech leaders very much the same. And the Bulgarian and Romanian leaders and Albanian leaders. Well, Albania is a case apart. Were going to keep the whole thing alive. The whole communist system was going to survive, no matter what. And of course, it didn't work out that way. In Czechoslovakia, the group of writers and intellectuals, Havel, who had signed Charter 77 and were put in jail as a result of that, who demanded reform, you already had in Czechoslovakia and in Poland and in Hungary, you already had intellectuals who were anti-communist or who were reforming communists meeting, sometimes very openly. And so in these countries, the transition to democracy or to parliamentary rule would be easier because the passing of the torch was easier. In Czechoslovakia, you know there were some parliamentary antecedents. Poland also did. Hungary less so, but you had this sort of flourishing alternative civil society that had been developing. And so the passing to the new generation, despite all the economic problems and despite the ethnic tensions that would remain, was much easier than it would be in Bulgaria, for example. In Bulgaria, what the leadership does, they feel cornered, so they try to accentuate anti-Turkish feeling because there are many Turks lived in Bulgaria. And so lots of Turks flee, and then they go to Turkey. In fact, they find that things are worse in Turkey, and many of them go back to Bulgaria. The tensions between the Romanians and the Hungarians in Romania helps generate change for reform because outside of Bucharest, the big calls for reform and the organization is the work of Hungarians who are living in the Hungarian parts of Romania. But yet the transition to parliamentary regime will be much harder in those places. The case of Bulgaria is particularly interesting. And it's also the one I know the least about, because they have just had, essentially the change is so slow in many ways of coming and of happening, and the kind of banditization or the kind of the sort of infiltration of major crime networks in Bulgaria really continue to run the show. And you found that to an extent in as everybody knows in Russia, but that's another that's another case. So the Velvet Revolution occurs in Czechoslovakia, and where the entire Politburo, that is the ruling group, resigned on November 19th, 1989. I mean, this is just a matter of a short period of time after the Berlin Wall essentially goes down. And so one of the interesting things about all this is that despite the ethnic tensions, huge ethnic tensions in many of these places, that you didn't have the kind of awful bloodbath that you would have in ex-Yugoslavia, which was primarily the work of the Serbs in those horrible, horrible wars that began bloodletting, ethnic cleansing, mass murder is a less fancy way of putting it than ethnic cleansing. For example, there were all these tensions between Poles and Ukraine because the parts of eastern Poland had passed back and forth, and lots of Ukrainians live in that part of Poland, and lots of Poles live near Lvov in Ukraine, and it actually you didn't have the and for all the sort of persecution of Russians, ethnic Russians living in Latvia above all, but also in Estonia and Lithuania. You really didn't have the kinds of massacres that happen in ex-Yugoslavia, and one of the reasons for that, two reasons for that. One is because of the ethnic religious complexity, in that the massacres were primarily perpetuated against Muslims by Orthodox Serbs who were inspired by one of the real villains of the last century or any century, Slobodan Milosevic, who died during his trial in The Hague, who kept talking about a greater Serbia to include Kosovo, to include everywhere else. And also on a more minor scale, those carried out by some Croatians against Muslims and all that. So that was major reason why you didn't have that same thing, that is the religious difference. And secondly is that in Ukraine, nobody was really talking about greater Ukraine, and people in Poland weren't talking about greater Poland, imagining annexing anybody they could possibly do the way Hitler had done or the way the Milosevic perpetuated his sleazy career as leader of the Yugoslav and then Serb Communist Party by giving inflammatory speeches in Kosovo, et cetera. So the whole thing collapses. Now, of course, this doesn't eliminate problems. If you don't have a real tradition of parliamentary rule, how do you rule? How do you suddenly have create parties that are viable? How do you create this sort of civic culture? And that's not very easy. And also, the Americans, particularly from the University of Chicago Economics School, were giving advice in Poland saying you just need an automatic infusion of capitalism that will solve everything. Well, that's not what happens at all. If anything, it increases the gap between very, very wealthy people, who formerly would have been party cadres in the Communist Party, and very ordinary people. And anyone who follows contemporary Russia now knows all that, or in the Côte d'Azur in Nice, in the Negresco Hotel in Nice, and all these, I shouldn't knock the Negresco, I've stayed there on a Yale alumni tour, but anyway, you find these extraordinarily wealthy Russian billionaires buying up everything, including soccer teams in Russia, I mean in England, where you still don't have, there are still people with not enough to eat. And other problems, these ethnic challenges, of course, are nowhere more graphically and horribly revealed than in the Balkans are there. The problem of all of these communist systems said, above all, you must have large-scale industry. So they start building these awfully soon out-of-date factories that crank out pollution at unimaginable levels. One of the effects is, for example, the destruction of the Black Forest in Germany by these clouds of pollution coming from the Czech Republic. And to say nothing of the nuclear, the fact that a lot of the Soviet nuclear installations were in Kazakhstan and other places, and trying to get these defused and demobilized, particularly when the United States now is trying, or has been under this last regime, has been trying to restart the arms race again. This is why, this is a personal comment, but too bad. I'm talking about how Europeans view America. The Americans now have this idea to put bases in Poland, and this is a terrible idea. Because these bases could be transformed into offensive weapons as well, and this can very well, as Putin, who sometimes can't be trusted, but nonetheless, and who is a vigorous, aggressive Russian nationalist, for better or for worse, that this could declench or start again this arms race, and that would be awful. So there's still lots of problems. What can one say? But yet, every time I go to Poland, as I said, it's very frequently now, and to other countries, I mean, there is just great hope. And there wasn't a lot of hope in 1987 or 1986. And suddenly it was this new, incredibly transformed world. In many places, it was easier to tear down, to say what you were against, that you didn't want this unreformed communist state, or you didn't want communism at all, than it was to sort of miraculously create this new a fairer world. And in Warsaw, I'm constantly amazed by, if you walk, Warsaw was completely rebuilt. When I was a kid, I was there, and it was, all you saw was rubble, basically. And now, when I walk out of the Hotel Bristol, a very fancy, famous hotel, and I turn left, it looks like the Champs-Élysées, or the Rue Saint-Honoré in Paris, all these fancy shops. And then as we go out to the university, then you see all these people still wearing the same threadbare coats, waiting in line for the trams as before the communist revolution. But yet things are better. One of the reasons, by the way, things are better in Poland is that they never did completely collectivize agriculture at all, that petit propriétaire, small units still existed, and so the transition there was as easy easier than in other places. Well, I mean, what can say? Again, this is what I'm going to say now is how Europeans view, view Europe, and also as kind of a European, I mean, how they view the United States. And I might certainly be tempted at the end to talk a little bit about that and about human rights. That, you know, we talk about globalization and all of that. José Bové lived in Los Angeles for 2 years. He's actually a city guy, but he made his reputation in the south of France, marching and with tractors, blocking French Air Force installations, trying to keep part of central Lower Massif Central called Larzac from being turned into a, you know, for testing, bomb testing, and all that business. And then he took his campaign against McDonald's. McDonald's, McDo, became identified with globalization and with Americanization. So the old kind of anti-American sentiment among intellectuals, and José Bové is that. When he came to Yale a couple years ago, Jim Scott brought him here to Yale, and actually my daughter took him to Rudy's. That's what she did. But they, when he came here, he came here as sort of a symbol of anti-globalization, and you've seen images of people in Seattle throwing themselves against the police, or against Nice, against police barricades, or in Nice, or in Italy as well. And globalization is sort of a catch-all, but if you don't believe that we live in a more global society, look at the impact of the economic crisis and how quickly that spread within the last 2 months. I mean, it's an obvious thing that we live in a world where, you know, Adidas and all these other shoes and shirts and t-shirts are often outsourced to extremely the poorest people they can find in Indonesia and other places. And when you get your phone, have some problem with your cell phone, I still don't have a cell phone or whatever, but you know, you end up talking to somebody in India or Pakistan as easily as you are talking to somebody in New Jersey. And so one aspect of globalization that is so much more visible now than even 15 years ago, and which fits exactly into one of the themes of this course, of course, obviously immigration. That there are no borders anymore. The creation of the European Union, for better or for worse, means that you can go from Calais all the way to Lithuania and never have your ID checked, not once. I travel on my French ID there. It's only in England and coming back to the United States that you need a passport at all. But the result is you've got all of these immigrants, and you've all seen pictures of bodies bobbing in the sea of Moroccans and people from Mali or Tunisia or Senegal trying to get into Spain, because once you got into Spain, you essentially got it made. The same passages that Spanish refugees fled Franco's terror during and after the Spanish Civil War bring people from Mali into France. And of course, female and male sex trafficking from Moldavia in particular, from Bulgaria, and from Albania, those are the three major points, is something that's just everywhere. And one of the immigrants are not new. In the 1960s, these governments said, please, they put up signs, please come to work in France, come to work in Germany, in Istanbul. So many Turks went to Germany. And then all of a sudden, you know, when the bottom of the economy falls out with the Arab oil embargo in 1973, 1974, then suddenly these people who helped make the economy run and who still help make the economy run, there's a whole, you know, a whole underground economy and do jobs at lots of other people, then suddenly say, we don't want them. And one of the risks that's an obvious risk to anyone who studied Germany in the 1920s and 30s, which you have, is that economic crisis causes people to scapegoat and to stereotype into scapegoat. And in countries like France, where the Gaullists made their pact with the devil and joined with the National Front, an over-the-top, aggressively racist a political party whose leader was a torturer, Jean-Marie Le Pen in Algeria, and who described the Holocaust as a minor detail of World War II, and whose supporters are negationists who believe that there wasn't a Holocaust. When they start, their discourse becomes extremely, extremely not only prevalent but acceptable, then you have a problem. Even in Switzerland, which does have very hard to become resident of Switzerland, which does have a large immigrant population, you had a party of the extreme right. In Denmark, one of the most tolerant places one could ever imagine, you had one of the most over-the-top and still have right-wing organizations. Heider, who just got himself killed in running his car off the road a couple of weeks ago in Austria, you know, he was unapologetic is probably a bit too strong, but he said things were much better when the Nazis were in control of the economy. We didn't have all these other people around. And that economic crisis and national stereotyping and racism is a recipe for disaster. And even in countries where democracy really, really works, when, you know, again, return to the case of Poland, when you have black players being taunted in soccer games, in Poland as in other countries, as in Spain, one of the worst of a kind of racist baiting that goes on when these clubs play. In France with Paris Saint-Germain, that's another classic example, or Lazio, which is the Mussolini granddaughter's favorite party and a team in Italy, then you've got a real problem. And when it becomes acceptable, and this is probably, maybe some of you may consider unfair, but when Sarkozy, president of France, he's the son of Hungarian immigrants, and when he borrows the language of racism, the language of Le Pen, to help put him over the top. And when someone interviewed Le Pen and said, why did you do so badly in the election, he said, and he was right, for once, he said, well, because they said the same things we're saying, then you've got a problem. You know, Fortress Europe may be trying to, you know, human rights, all these human rights documents give people the right to emigrate, but not to immigrate. And how these countries, including ours, treat people who are legal immigrants and those who are illegal immigrants is a true test of the kinds of values that they have. And this is an obvious thing to say, but this is the next is the future of, this is an ongoing problem, an ongoing challenge in every single European country, that toleration, you know, civic harmony, generosity, caring in hard times is under assault. And our country has never been immune from that as well. And this is it's an obvious case, but it's something that's going to concern people that work on Europe. Look at the role of xenophobia in the rise of the right in the 1920s, and above all in the 1930s. The same thing over and over again. And just to end, you know, to end with this, there's the question of human rights. And Europeans have a hard time understanding the United States. They don't understand capital punishment. They understand why you can just pick up a gun. You know, you can't vote, but you can buy a machine gun at some gun show almost anywhere you are, north or south. And they can't understand that. But one of the other things they can't understand is why in this country we have a deep abiding institutionalized belief in the right to bear arms, et cetera, et cetera. But in civic rights or civil rights, you know, your rights is defined by being a member of the state. But we don't have often not accepted human rights as a category. And Europeans are often just mystified by this. Let me give you, you know, an example that, you know, that again, this is not politics, but I can't help saying this, that it's very difficult to explain to people how it is that United States in the last few years finds itself on a list of countries that torture. Not big time, not Nazi Germany, not Stalin, not even the level of course Pinochet, who they tried to extradite and they tried to do everything. Not on the level of Milosevic, who finally was carted off to tribunal. But the United States, in the smirks of President George Bush, and Cheney and these people put us on a list of torturers, and Guantanamo, that hurt the United States. The view that people have of the United States in ways that are simply unimaginable. The idea that you have these people, you know, some of them are some really bad people. Other people just got sort of caught up in the wrong thing. But even if they're bad people, they never had charges pressed against them, and you see them in their you know, chained to the ground with their little you know, orange uniforms, and you see the images that came out of the prisons, or you have, you know, Blackwater or these private contractors gunning down civilians with impunity. This stuff didn't used to happen in this country. That even during Vietnam, you know, when Callie murdered all those people in Vietnam, and you don't remember Vietnam, Bob and a few others remember Vietnam, but, you know, he went on trial. But when states become involved with this, with kidnapping people off the streets, you know, what do they call it, and secret plane flights to England or to wherever. This is what made the United States lose so much of its image, of its éclat, of its respect. It's incredible. I mean, even in a place that I live with 330 people, and people are not terribly politicized. You know, the politics is still families that have hated each other for generations. But there is this image of how could this happen in the United States? It was always the place that you wanted to go to because things were fair, things were right. You know, I believe, nobody asked me, but since we're talking about the view of Europeans, you know, I believe that people like Bush and Cheney ought to go before the tribunal in The Hague. If human rights is going to mean anything, that because they're from the most powerful country in the world doesn't mean that they shouldn't face the same kind of standards that you all believe in, and it should be that way. Bernard Kouchner is a sort of moderate politician in France. He's somewhat socialist, but he's in the government of Sarkozy. And he was the one who helped, one of the original creators of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. You know, and all these people, French, but not just French, Americans and other people, many of you may do this, go off and try to help, my friend who's a physician's assistant, goes off to Guatemala all the time to help people in Nicaragua. And Kouchner, you know, is a really good guy, and he's very pro-American. And he said, this is just chilling, it ought to be chilling for you. He said that the magic is done. The magic is over. That's exactly what he said. He said it in English, too. He said, the magic is over. What was the magic? It was what this country represents to Europeans. The magic is over. And then he paused and he said, things will never be the same again. So, you know, I guess just in conclusion, that it's up to you to believe in human rights and believe in the value of people, whether they're clandestine or legal immigrants or not, and that human rights should be written on the face of this country as well, and that you can restore that magic.